Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So that would be The Media Project, an opportunity for you to get a half hour of analysis, commentary, and if we're lucky, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week.
Yeah, you know, Rex and Judy, I love the idea of what you always say, Rex, which is the idea that we could, you know, analysis becomes very important. I've heard Judy say that too, because newspapers don't do the same thing they didn't. So, for example, right now, Elliot Spitzer is way ahead in the polls in New York City for mayor.
Before you just get too carried away with political analysis, can I introduce who the people are here at the show here?
No.
This is he's Dr. Alan Shartok, in case you've been under a rock for the last 50 years. He's the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Judy Patrick is here from the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. What were you about to say, Dr. Shartok?
I was going to say, when you said the last 50 years, don't think I didn't get it. And I see your real gray hair, much grayer than mine.
So, to the extent that you can find any. But
so anyway, what I was going to say, so Elliot Spitzer, now he's ahead in all the polls. Both tabloids in New York have been nothing but sort of mean to him. But the voters somehow have a different view of this. They say, okay, so you did sex with prostitutes, but we remember you when you were attorney general and you went after the big boys in Wall Street, and we think you're going to do the same thing when you're the city controller. And Elliot, all he says about the other guy who didn't go with prostitutes is, you know, your problem is, you know, you're just the same old from the same crowd. And it works.
And it works.
But where is the analysis to make it a Media Project subject?
And how far ahead is he? Is it like 19 points?
19 points.
According to the Q poll, yeah.
Yeah. And when you got all that money, it can only be better.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
Americans respect money, you know.
Is that what it is?
It is our aristocracy.
I think we're saps for it, is basically it. I think we can be bought. Our attention can be bought by a lot of money, and it works.
Is that Rex speaking now?
Yeah, I just wish that more money would go to a newspaper advertising to buy people's attention.
Yeah, but it does show the value of polls in covering a political campaign. I don't think you should only cover polls, but it does reflect the movement of the voters and something to talk about.
I agree with you, Judy. Unusually, I agree with you and Rex at the same time.
You guys cover polls?
I don't like to cover a lot of polls. I don't like the polls to drive our campaign coverage. I want to talk about the issues. But in this case, it is interesting. It makes you think the voters are looking at more than just the sex scandals.
No, but I think what you said before is exactly right, Judy. The whole idea of this is fluid. And you want to see what? You want to wait until the election and not cover any polls? I think people have to have a sense of where things are going, so they'll know how to vote. So, for example,
how to vote?
So I want to be with the winner. That's what they're saying.
Well, yeah. So that's the danger. I think that's what Judy's alluding to. You don't want to let the polls guide your campaign coverage, because then you suddenly start to make a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, there's no way you can stop it. And I happen to think, as a political scientist with a PhD, the only one in the room, let the record show Judy.
Fortunately,
looking
this is a program about journalism.
No, but I happen to think it is important as a part of the way in which things develop.
But how important?
I think very important. I don't know. I mean, you know, the electorate is giving, is this is feedback from the electorate, and I like that. The general electorate.
Feedback.
In Schenectady.
The feedback is one thing, though there has been an effort to correct it in the past few election cycles. But gosh, the over-reliance on polls as driving the storyline. And of course, the modern journalism, the way we cover politics now, began with 1960 with Theodore White's The Making of the President, was expanded upon in 72 by Tim Krause's book, The Boys on the Bus.
Yep.
And now really we're in an era when we look so much at the techniques of the campaign. We look at, we have journalists who are embedded with campaigns, really.
In more ways than one.
Well, this could be. Covering stuff minute by minute in the campaigns. But the other side of it is that people don't like to pay that much attention to the really critical issues that they ought to be confronting.
Well, you know, Rexy, whether you like it or not, the horse is out of the barn. And if you decided, the Times Union decided, for example, we're not going to print all these polls and pay all attention, or Judy in the Gazette, people would get it. We'd put it on the radio tomorrow.
That's right, because your standards are lower. So.
Well, our standards are different.
All right, and so horses do get out of the barn, but they can be brought back in.
Oh,
lasso
really?
Them and bring
are you
them
sure?
back in. Yeah.
Not after the barn burned down.
And so what you can do is, sure, you can continue to cover polls, but you also can cover the issues in the election and stop covering the campaign like a sport. It's not a sport. It's a really important
Well,
decision.
That's an interesting question. Is a campaign a sport or is it not? And I suspect campaigns have become sport.
Well, I think that it's because of political analysts, with all due respect.
Now it's getting personal,
who
right?
Who insist on making this everything about the horse race, you know, and wanting to talk about the campaigns and everything. And let's see who's ahead of who and everything. And we
why are they ahead? I mean, I think you guys fall down on the job, to be perfectly honest with you, now that you've opened up the door.
So why is Spitzer ahead?
He's ahead because people think he has the properties.
He's ahead because they know him and they don't know who Scott Stringer is.
I guess I haven't been able to finish my sentence.
Oh, it's always a problem around here. You get so little opportunity to speak.
I think that the reason that he's ahead is that they loved what he did as attorney general, that he went after those guys on the street, that he's going to do it again as controller. I tell you what I think he's going to do. He's going to take those shares that he votes on the pension fund, and he's going to go in and he's going to say, explain yourself. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Is that illegal? And I think New Yorkers are a very sophisticated crowd, especially, you know, those people down there in the Big Apple, and they keep an eye on it. And they're going to say,
You know what he's going to do as city controller? He's going to savage the guy at the top of the organization the way that Andrew Cuomo did the governor of New York when Andrew Cuomo was attorney general. And he's going to then become the next mayor of New York City. That's what's going to happen. He's going to start his campaign for mayor of New York right away as soon as he's elected controller. That's my prediction. But
well,
that's
you
my
know,
political analysis, not a journalistic one. Sorry.
But no, that's fine. I think that that's the kind of thing you guys ought to be saying more of in the paper. I think, you know, you're on the editorial board. You ought to be saying that kind of thing, because I happen to be a big believer in Elliot Spitzer. And I think that when he becomes mayor of New York, if he were in this campaign legitimately now, if they would let him in, they won't because of all the stuff. I think the extraterrestrial guys will come after him.
You're looking at me.
What I mean by that is I think what's going to happen is if democracy rules and he gets elected, then I think you're going to see some of the prosecutors who could have gone after him in a different way. I think that they're going to rev those guys up to go after him. This is a dirty game.
Well, here we are upstate.
We're not as politically sophisticated.
They're different. The thing about upstaters that I love is upstaters are really able to, you know, unlike the New York City folks, upstaters are able to balance things very nicely, and because they have a sense of humility and other things, and that's why I love upstaters.
All right, let's hear it. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok here to give you some thoughts. We had someone who wrote to us, one of our listeners, to suggest that we pay attention to a New York Times story. In the New York Times, as Snowden mentioned, speaking, of course, of the, he said, quote, "In the wake of this year's disclosure, it should be clear that unencrypted journalist source communication is unforgivably reckless." So our listener, Dick, writes to us and says, "In light of recent revelations, have there been changes in the minimum level of due diligence required for reporters to protect sources? If I were a source, I would sure not trust a reporter who uses a phone or unencrypted text? What about newsroom editorial offices? Aren't you forced to assume that they are bugged and that all of your internal communications are archived somewhere in government databases? You need not deal in national security topics to be surveilled.
Could you guys, one of the two of you, Judy, maybe tell me what unencrypted means for the sake
or encrypted? That means that it's secret until it's decoded, and so there's a level of protection as it travels from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess this is a whole nother problem for us to deal with in the business.
Well, I like one line that he said. He said, never trust a reporter. I mean, if I'm talking on the phone with somebody and they say, oh, can we leave this off the record? And they do what they're supposed to and say, okay, let's leave it off the record.
That's
and then
works.
Do I think that somehow it has a way of finding its way into print? Yes, I do.
What he was saying was, I would not trust a reporter who uses a phone or unencrypted text. I mean, that's a pretty aggressive notion that you can't talk to somebody unless it's encrypted.
Well, not only that, not only because of the people who may be listening, the NSA or anything else, but also because the reporters sometimes cheat.
Cheat?
Yeah. Some guy called me up. I'll never forget it. I may have mentioned this 100 times in the past. He calls me up and I say, off the record. He says, yeah, off the record. And he calls back and says, now here's what I'm saying. And I knew he was calling back because I knew he was going to cheat. And because I had said off the record. And could we say? And I say, wait a second now, that was off the record. And he said, oh, let me go back and check my notes, which means he was recording me, I believe. And he wanted to check whether or not I had entered into a negotiation and a deal with him.
Aha. Uh-huh. And what happened?
It never got printed.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
So then, he honored the author.
He honored your...
But I had to insist that it be honored.
Well, it could be that he misunderstood. And I think it's great, by the way, that he called you back and read stuff back to you. That's really good work by the reporter, double-checking
things.
I
happen to think that Santa Claus just pulled his sled into the studio right now.
I think that
he
reporter did the right stuff.
What'd you say?
The reporter did the right thing.
Yeah, he did the right thing because he was scared to death I was going to yell and scream.
So in this case, it's not the reporter they're worried about. It's the,
the outside.
Big Brother they're worried about.
Right.
Big Brother dropping in. And do I think that Big Brother is monitoring the emails my reporters send out? You know, I'm a Pollyanna naive. I'm not thinking
you
it's
are
happening.
Not.
I'm not thinking
you
it's
act
happening.
That way.
But the best way for a reporter to get information is to talk face to face to a source.
That's absolutely right.
Not always possible, but the best way.
What, you think they don't have a little bug in their pocket? I mean, somebody's honing in with a laser-like device from outer space or from satellite?
We have some reporters who are really meticulous, especially when they're doing pieces that could get sources in trouble.
Yeah.
If someone is a whistleblower in an agency who is telling a reporter stuff, the reporter will, as Judy says, insist on, hey, let's just meet in public. I have a reporter who says that the only appropriate email message to someone that you're interviewing is, hey, give me a call. And then when that person calls, he'll say, hey, let me give you another number. And this reporter, for example, will go to payphones, which are hard to find these days.
Sure.
But he does not like to do any significant interviews on the newsroom telephone because he figures there is every good chance that at least, especially if you're dealing with a state agency, phone records can be taken from state employees and they can look at where those calls went. And if they see that number, that Times Union telephone number, they figure, aha, this is the person who's leaked this information.
Well, on the other hand, we have a Vox Pop program every day from 2 to 3 here on public radio, and people call in. And there is not a day that you don't hear from somebody who claims the ultimate conspiracy is going on. I don't care what you're talking about. It's, ha, 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 you really believe that? That's not the way it is. This whole thing is a fix from the very beginning. Very hard to argue with that, except to say you don't believe it.
Uh-huh.
But it is scary with the technology increasing the way that it is. I mean, the New York Times talking about how all the snail mail in the entire postal system are being photographed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that gives you a pretty good hint.
By the way, what we're talking about, this notion of using encrypted technology, has to do with Edward Snowden being interviewed in a New York Times Magazine profile.
Sure.
And one of the things that he said when he was asked about why is it, and again, he was being interviewed via encrypted technology.
Is this before Russia or after Russia?
I don't know.
Because
exactly
I know that the Putin deal with him is that he's not allowed to talk.
Ah, well, then this suggests this would have been before, because apparently via this transcript, he was asked why he sought out The Guardian, for example, rather than major American news outlets. And here's what Edward Snowden said. Consider him a hero or a scourge, whichever you like. Here's what he said. After 9/11, many of the most important news outlets in America abdicated their role as a check to power, the journalistic responsibility to challenge the excesses of government for fear of being seen as unpatriotic and punished in the market during a period of heightened nationalism. From a business perspective, this was the obvious strategy, but what benefited the institutions ended up costing the public dearly. The major outlets are still only beginning to recover from this cold period. So that's very interesting. That's Edward Snowden speaking about American media and why he chose an English newspaper, The Guardian, to drop his information.
Mm-hmm.
Abdicate's a pretty strong word, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they abdicated. It's an overstatement, I think. I think it's true that patriotism was really important and there was a lessening of scrutiny on the government, but I think it wasn't a total abdication.
Well, you see, I can expect from both of you, because you're both great newspaper editors of two major papers, that you will always take the defense on this. You know, it's not total abdication. It's not real. But I think that the writer has a point that, you know, in the old Soviet Union, what was going to be in Pravda was somewhat predictable. And, you know, there is an overwhelming push now to make Snowden into a bad guy. You see it everywhere. And the question is, who doesn't go along with that when you see the Congress people say it and the other people say it and you say, oh, boy, do I want to be on the wrong side of this one? That takes a lot of guts.
It obscures the issue, though. Focusing on Snowden obscures the fact that the issue at hand really is America really, uh-oh, why is he looking at me? Is America really inappropriately digging into people's personal lives? Are we going too far in scrutiny? Is the FISA court inappropriately unmonitored? And that's really the issue rather than looking at...
No, that is an issue. It isn't the issue. The issue is this guy is the ultimate whistleblower. He comes up and he puts out there everything he's got. And that's an issue. Is he disloyal? Is he a traitor? And then...
That's a little bit of an issue, I'd say. The bigger issue is what he tried to expose rather than who he is or what his role is.
Well, by the way, that's his excuse for why he's not talking from Russia. We know why he's not talking from Russia. At least I think I do, which is that Putin said, you want to stay here? You do that, otherwise you go back. And that was sort of Putin's way of dealing with this thing. But his rationale is just what you said. I don't want to make this personal about me. It's not. It's much more important philosophically that we look at all those issues you raised.
Yeah, I think if he were a real upstanding guy, he'd be doing a Daniel Ellsberg. He'd take the penalty that might accrue to him rather than fleeing to a, you know, a repressive regime.
But, to which I say, that's easy for you to say.
Yeah, but still, I think that all still is should be of lesser importance to American people, him, than the issue that he raises.
So, I'm not sure you're right.
Interesting. So we should talk about NPR here, since everybody who listens to this program, almost everybody, I think, is listening to this on an NPR member station.
Well, they're commercial stations, but it's okay.
It's a good thing. Those of you who are listening in Southern Indiana
maybe.
Or Nacogdoches, Texas.
Nacogdoches, maybe.
San Diego. We're very happy to have you. Anyway, there has been quite a hullabaloo within NPR over a story that you well may remember from a couple of years ago. There was an NPR broadcast in 2011, which I personally remember because it dealt with my home state of South Dakota. You know, I'm from the Black Hills.
No kidding. You're from South Dakota.
Who knew? And so there was a three-part series at NPR broadcast having to do with Indian children, children taken from the reservations, which are mostly Lakota Sioux in South Dakota, and sent to foster homes elsewhere in the state. There was such a controversy about it because the story essentially alleged that state officials were doing this, taking these children from the reservation and placing them in white families' homes, in part because the state got payments from the federal government for each child who was placed
right.
into a foster home.
But it turns out...
Well, the NPR ombudsman, a man named Edward, the current one, named Edward Schumacher Matos, did a massive report basically checking out this whole series. He did 30,000 words.
It was a book, chapters.
It was a book, yes. And he basically said this story was fundamentally flawed, shouldn't have been aired the way it was. And now there's the controversy about, well, has NPR overdone it? Did this ombudsman's report, did this story really merit this kind of attention?
And I'm not really clear still whether or not the report was fundamentally flawed, whether the premise was wrong, or whether they just got some facts wrong, which is a very serious thing. but was the gist of the report wrong?
Well, the NPR defense, I believe, as I remember this, is that, not having prepared as well as you guys, I think that the NPR defense is that they got some facts wrong, but that didn't change the thing.
Right, exactly. And NPR, Kinsey Wilson, who's the head of content for NPR, former Newsday colleague of mine, by the way, who's a bright
young
reporter.
You worked at
Newsday? What do you know? And Kinsey, who's also been a former editor of, or executive editor of USA Today, so he's a real solid journalist with strong credentials. He says NPR stands by the stories. He says that they are not backing away from it, despite, as you say, some errors in it. I have to tell you that when I heard the series, I didn't hear all three parts of it.
Yeah.
I heard parts of it. I remember thinking, whoa, is that fundamentally possible that state officials in South Dakota, which I grant you is an odd place, that they could be so evil as to take children away from their parents for this financial gain. So in any case, it is something that readers may wish to check out. I'm sure you can find more at npr.org and look into the ombudsman's report. Ombudsmen are hired by news organizations to sort of double check, to be an independent check on what they do.
Yeah, well, you know, I have certain concerns about the ombudsman movement, to be honest with you. And I know you do too, Rex, because this is something that is problematic in some cases. I have seen some of these ombudsmen go off the reservation. And there's one I've got in my sights right now for some of the stuff that he's been writing. And I tell you, I think it's a very interesting thing. You hire somebody, you say, we're not going to have anything to do with you. And if the guy turns out to be a nut, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I've always thought that it's dangerous to say to somebody, you get to have such a wide berth that you can second guess the entire editorial team of a news organization, this one individual, which is fundamentally what you give them.
What do you think, Judy?
And in this NPR case, it leaves the public ultimately confused about whether or not the report was valid or not. It doesn't seem to further the public's understanding of the basic issue about what was happening in South Dakota.
On the other hand, it's good that, you know, NPR has to stand up and defend itself if, in fact, their report was flawed.
Yep, absolutely. Hey, by the way, in the annals of how things are going in the digital world, the San Francisco Chronicle has dropped its paywall, which it erected just about, 3 months ago or so, and has decided now that what they do is they created a second website. They had sfgate.com, and they decided to create a website that would have all the content of the newspaper that would be less mass appeal, more for the journalism, more like a newspaper reading experience that they called sanfranciscochronicle.com. And people would have to pay for that, I think $12 a month, and they've dropped that paywall.
You can just see the advertising guys who are trying to sell the ads on the paper, the electronic paper, saying, hey, you know, we got so many fewer numbers. Our people are coming to us and saying, hey, our numbers aren't adequate to pay what you want us to pay, so you got to drop the paywall. On the other hand, Judy, your paper has always had a paywall, right?
Right, we've had it. That's correct. And one of the things we argue is that our readers are premium readers, that they're there because they want to be there and they're actually reading their stories. They're just not dropping in. They tend to be local people, and as such, the advertisers will get more value for each of our clicks. I don't know why San Francisco did that. It's not indicated here why.
I just told you why.
Just to get the hits.
It's all about money.
And so they're going to keep these two parallel sites going.
At least for the time being, it seems to be the case.
You know, if you go to Judy's paper, to the Gazette, the question is, they give you a little taste. They say, if you want to read the whole article, go here.
So the idea here is that if you create a premium site, that people will pay for the premium content. And apparently in this case, they are deciding that it's not working.
Well, we'll have to see, because it works for the New York Times, it works for the Wall Street Journal, and from your point of view, it works for the Daily Gazette. We'll see over time how it goes.
Just to explain something everybody should know. When I referred to the sophistication of the New York City people, I want you to know that I think that the upstate people are really very special.
Since you depend upon the money from both ends, don't you? The New York City folks and upstate folks support the radio station.
Well, yes.
Yes. Okay. Therefore, we'll hope you come back next week wherever you're from.
Thanks a lot, Rex.
It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.